Paladin of the Lost Hour. This was an old man. Not an incredibly old man, obsolete, spavined. Not as worn as the sway-backed stone steps ascending the Pyramid of the Sun to an ancient temple. Not yet a relic. But even so, a very old man, this old man, perched on an antique shooting stick, its handles open to form a seat, its spike thrust at an angle into the soft ground and trimmed grass of the cemetery. Gray, thin rain misted down at almost the same angle as that at which the spike pierced the ground. The winter-barren trees lay flat and black against an aluminum sky, unmoving in the chill wind. An old man sitting at the foot of a grave mound whose headstone had tilted slightly when the earth had settled, sitting in the rain and speaking to someone below.
"They tore it down, Minna. I tell you, they must have bought off a councilman. Came in with bulldozers at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you know that's not legal. There's a municipal code. Supposed to hold off till at least 7 on weekdays, 8 on the weekend. But there they were at 6, even before 6. Barely light, for God's sakes. Thought they'd sneak in and do it before the neighborhood got wind of it and called the Landmarks Committee. Sneaks! They come on holidays, can you imagine? But I was out there waiting for them, and I told them, you can't do it. That's code number 91.3002, subsection E. And they lied. And they said they had special permission. So I said to the big mucky-muck in charge, let's see your waiver permit. And he said the code didn't apply in this case because it was supposed to be only for grading. And since they were demolishing and not grading, they could start whenever they felt like it. So I told him I'd call the police then because it came under the heading of disturbing the peace. And he said, well, I know you hate that kind of language, old girl, so I won't tell you what he said, but you can imagine. So I called the police and gave them my name, and of course they didn't get there till almost 7:15, which is what makes me think they bought off a councilman, and by then those dozers had leveled most of it. It doesn't take long, you know that. And I don't suppose it's as great a loss as maybe, say, the Great Library of Alexandria, but it was the last of the authentic deco-design drive-ins, and the car hop still served you on roller skates, and it was a landmark, and just about the only place left in the city where you could still get a decent grilled cheese sandwich pressed very flat on the grill by one of those weights they used to use, and made with real cheese and not that rancid plastic they cut into squares and they call it cheese food. Gone, old dear, gone and mourned. And I understand they plan to put up another one of those mini-malls on the site, just 10 blocks away from one that's already there. And you know what's going to happen. This new one will drain off the traffic from the older one, and then that one will fail the way they all do when the next one gets built. I mean, you'd think they'd see some history in it, but no, they never learn. And you should have seen the crowd by 7:30. All ages, even some of those kids painted like Aborigines with torn leather clothing. Even they came to protest. Terrible language, but at least they were concerned. And nothing could stop it. They just whammed it, and down it went. I do so miss you today, Minna. No more good grilled cheese, said the very old man to the ground. And now he was crying softly, and now the wind rose and the mist rain stippled his overcoat. Nearby, yet at a distance, Billy Canetta stared down at another grave. He could see the old man over there off to his left, but he took no further notice. The wind whipped the vent of his trench coat. His collar was up, but rain trickled down his neck. This was a younger man, not yet 35. Unlike the old man, Billy Canetta neither cried nor spoke to memories of someone who had once listened. He might have been a geomancer, so silently did he stand, eyes toward the ground. One of these men was black, the other was white. Beyond the high spiked iron fence surrounding the cemetery, two boys crouched, staring through the bars, through the rain, at the men absorbed by grave matters, by matters of graves. These were not really boys, they were legally young men. One was 19, the other 2 months beyond 20. Both were legally old enough to vote, to drink alcoholic beverages, to drive a car. Neither would reach the age of Billy Canetta. One of them said, let's take the old man. The other responded, you think the guy in the trench coat will get in the way? The first one smiled in a mean little laugh. I sure as shit hope so. He wore on his right hand a leather Carnaby glove with the fingers cut off, small round metal studs in a pattern along the line of his knuckles. He made a fist, flexed, and did it again.
They went under the spiked fence at a point where erosion had created a shallow gully.
Son of a bitch,
one of them said, as he slid through on his stomach. It was muddy. The front of his sateen roadie jacket was filthy.
Son of a bitch!
He was speaking in general of the fence, the sliding under the muddy ground, the universe in total, and the old man, who would now really get the crap kicked out of him for making this fine sateen roadie jacket filthy.
Son of a bitch!
They sneaked up on him from the left, as far from the young guy in the trench coat as they could. The first one kicked out the shooting stick with a short, sharp, downward movement he had learned in his taekwondo class. It was called the yuchage. The old man went over backward. Then they were on him, the one with the filthy son-of-a-bitch sateen roadie jacket, punching at the old man's neck and the side of his face as he dragged him around by the collar of the overcoat. The other one began ransacking the coat pockets, ripping the fabric to get his hand inside. The old man commenced to scream.
Protect me! You've got to protect me! It's necessary to protect me!
The one pillaging pockets froze momentarily. What the hell kind of a thing is that for this old fucker to be saying? Who the hell does he think will protect him? Is he asking us to protect him? I'll protect you, scumbag. I'll kick in your fucking lung. Shut him up, he whispered urgently to his friend. Stick a fist in his mouth. Then his hand, wedged in an inside jacket pocket, closed over something. He tried to get his hand loose, but the jacket and coat and the old man's body had wound around his wrist. Come on, loose motherfucker, he said to the very old man, who was still screaming for protection. The other young man was making huffing sounds as dark as mud as he slapped at the rain-soaked hair of his victim. I can't. He's all twisted around. Get your hand out of this so I can... Screaming, the old man had doubled under, locking their hands on his person. And then the pillager's fist came loose, and he was clutching, for an instant, a gorgeous pocket watch. What used to be called a turnip watch. The dial face was cloisonné, exquisite beyond the telling. The case was of silver, so bright it seemed blue. The hands, cast as arrows of time, were gold. They formed a shallow V at precisely 11 o'clock. This was happening at 3:45 in the afternoon, with rain and wind. And the timepiece made no sound, no sound at all. Then, there was space all around the watch, and in that space in the palm of the hand there was heat. Intense heat for just a moment, just long enough for the hand to open. And the watch glided out of the boy's palm and levitated.
Help me! You must protect me!
Billy Canetta heard the shrieking, but did not see the pocket watch floating in the air above the astonished young man. It was silver, and it was end on toward him, and the rain was silver and slanting. And he did not see the watch hanging free in the air, even when the furious young man disentangled himself and leaped for it. Billy did not see the watch rise just so much out of reach of the mugger. Billy Canetta saw two boys, two young men of Rat Pack age, beating someone much older, and he went for them. Pow! Like that. Thrashing his legs, the old man twisted around, over, under, as the boy holding him by the collar tried to land a punch to put him away. Who would have thought the old man to have had so much battle in him? A flapping shape, screaming something unintelligible, hit the center of the group at full speed. The Carnaby-gloved hand reaching for the watch grasped at empty air one moment, and the next was buried under its owner as the boy was struck a crackback block that threw him face first into the soggy ground. He tried to rise, but something stomped him at the base of his spine. Something kicked him twice in the kidneys. Something rolled over him like a flash flood. Twisting, twisting, the very old man put his thumb in the right eye of the boy, clutching his collar. The great trench-coated maelstrom that was Billy Canetta whirled into the boy as he let loose of the old man on the ground and, howling, slapped a palm against his stinging eye. Billy locked his fingers and delivered a roundhouse wallop that sent the boy reeling backward to fall over Minna's tilted headstone. Billy's back was to the old man. He did not see the miraculous pocket watch smoothly descend through rain that did not touch it to hover in front of the old man. He did not see the old man reach up, did not see the timepiece snuggle into an arthritic hand, did not see the old man return the turnip to an inside jacket pocket. Wind, rain, and Billy Canetta pummeled two young men of a legal age that made them accountable for their actions. There was no thought of the knife stuck down in one boot, no chance to reach it, no moment when the wild thing let them rise. So they crawled. They scrabbled across the muddy ground, the slippery grass, over graves and out of his reach. They ran, falling, rising, falling again, away, without looking back. Billy Canetta, breathing heavily, knees trembling, turned to help the old man to his feet, and found him standing, brushing dirt from his overcoat, snorting in anger and mumbling to himself. Are you all right? For a moment, the old man's recitation of annoyance continued. Then he snapped his chin down sharply, as if marking end to the situation, and looked at his cavalry to the rescue. "That was very good, young fellow. Considerable style you've got there." Billy Canetta stared at him wide-eyed. "Are you sure you're okay?" He reached over and flicked several blades of wet grass from the shoulder of the old man's overcoat.
"I'm fine. I'm fine, but I'm wet and I'm cranky. Let's go somewhere and have a nice cup of Earl Grey."
There had been a look on Billy Canetta's face as he stood with lowered eyes, staring at the grave he had come to visit. The emergency had removed that look. Now it returned.
No, thanks. If you're okay, I've got to do some things."
The old man felt himself all over meticulously as he replied,
"I'm only superficially bruised. Now, if I were an old woman instead of a spunky old man, same age though, I'd have lost considerable of the calcium in my bones, and those two would have done me some mischief. Did you know that women lose a considerable part of their calcium when they reach my age? I read a report."
Then he paused and said shyly,
"Come on, why don't you and I sit and chew the fat over a nice cup of tea?"
Billy shook his head with bemusement, smiling despite himself. "Here's something else, Dad. I don't even know you."
"I like that."
"What, that I don't know you?"
"No, that you call me Dad and not Pop. I hate Pop. It always makes me think the wise apple wants to snap off my cap with a bottle opener. Now, Dad has a ring of respect to it. I like that right down to the ground. Yes, I believe we should find someplace warm and quiet to sit and get to know each other. After all, you saved my life, and you know what that means in the Orient."
Billy was smiling continuously now. "In the first place, I doubt very much I saved your life. Your wallet, maybe. And in the second place, I don't even know your name. What would we have to talk about?"
"Gaspar," he said, extending his hand. "That's the first name, Gaspar. You know what it means?"
Billy shook his head.
"See? Already we have something to talk about."
So Billy, still smiling, began walking Gaspar out of the cemetery. "Where do you live? I'll take you home." They were on the street, approaching Billy Canetta's 1979 Cutlass.
"Where I live is too far for now. I'm beginning to feel a bit peaky. I'd like to lie down for a minute. We can just go on over to your place, if that doesn't bother you. For a few minutes. A cup of tea. Is that all right?"
He was standing beside the Cutlass, looking at Billy with an old man's expectant smile, waiting for him to unlock the door and hold it for him till he'd placed his still calcium-rich but nonetheless old bones in the passenger seat. Billy stared at him, trying to figure out what was at risk if he unlocked that door. Then he snorted a tiny laugh, unlocked the door, held it for Gaspar as he seated himself, slammed it, and went around to unlock the other side and get in. Gaspar reached across and thumbed up the door lock knob, and they drove off together in the rain.
Through all of this, the timepiece made no sound. No sound at all.
Like Gaspar, Billy Canetta was alone in the world. His three-room apartment was the vacuum in which he existed. It was furnished, but if one stepped out into the hallway and, for all the money in all the numbered accounts in all the banks in Switzerland, one were asked to describe those furnishings, one would come away no richer than before. The apartment was charisma poor. It was a place to come when all other possibilities had been expended. Nothing green, nothing alive existed in those boxes. No eyes looked back from the walls. Neither warmth nor chill marked those spaces. It was a place to wait. Gaspar leaned his closed shooting stick, now a walking stick with handles, against the bookcase. He studied the titles of the paperbacks stacked haphazardly on the shelves. From the kitchenette came the sound of water running into a metal pan, then tin on cast iron. Then the hiss of gas and the flaring of a match as it was struck and the pop of the gas being lit.
"Many years ago," Gaspar said, taking out a copy of Moravia's The Adolescents and thumbing it as he spoke, "I had a library of books, oh, thousands of books, never could bear to toss one out, not even the bad ones. And when folks would come to the house to visit, they'd look around at all the nooks and crannies stuffed with books. And if they were the sort of folks who don't snuggle with books, they'd always ask the same dumb question."
He waited a moment for a response, and when none was forthcoming, the sound of china cups on sink tile, he said,
"Guess what the question was?"
From the kitchen, without much interest,
"No idea." "They'd always ask her with the same kind of voice people use in the presence of large sculptures in museums. And they'd ask me, have you read all these books?
He waited again, but Billy Canetta was not playing the game.
Well, young fella, after a while the same dumb question gets asked a million times, you get sort of snappish about it, and it came to annoy me more than a little bit, till I finally figured out the right answer. And you know what that answer was? I say, you know what that answer was? Go ahead, take a guess.
Billy appeared in the kitchenette doorway. I suppose you told them you'd read a lot of them, but not all of them. Gaspar waved the guess away with a flapping hand. Now, what good would that have done? I mean, they wouldn't have known they'd asked a dumb question, but I didn't want to insult them either. So when they asked if I'd read all those books, I'd say, hell no! Who wants a library full of books you've already read? Billy laughed despite himself. He scratched at his hair with idle pleasure and shook his head at the old man's verve. Gaspar, you are a wild old man. You retired? The old man walked carefully to the most comfortable chair in the room, an overstuffed 30-style lounge that had been reupholstered many times before Billy Canetta had purchased it at the American Cancer Society thrift shop. He sank into it with a sigh.
No, sir, I am not by any means retired. I'm still very active, very active.
But doing what if I'm not prying?
Doing ombudsman.
You mean like a consumer advocate like Ralph Nader?
Exactly. I watch out for things. I listen. I pay some attention. If I do it right, sometimes I can even make a little difference. Yes, like Mr. Nader. Very fine man, Mr. Nader. Very, very, very fine man.
And you were at the cemetery to see a relative? Gaspar's face settled into an expression of loss. My dear old girl. My wife, Minna. She's been gone, well, it was 20 years in January. He sat silently staring inward for a while, and then, she was everything to me. The nice part was that I knew how important we were to each other. We discussed, well, just everything. I miss that the most, telling her what's going on. I go to see her every other day. I used to go every day, but it hurt too much. They had tea. Gaspar sipped and said it was very nice, but had Billy ever tried Earl Grey? Billy said he didn't know what that was, and Gaspar said he would bring him a tin, that it was splendid. And they chatted. Finally, Gaspar asked, And who were you visiting? Billy pressed his lips together. Just a friend. And would say no more. Then he sighed and said, Well... Listen, I have to go to work.
Oh, what do you do?
The answer came slowly, as if Billy Canetta wanted to be able to say that he was in computers, or owned his own business, or held a position of import. I'm a night manager at a 7-Eleven.
Well, I'll bet you meet some fascinating people coming in late for milk or one of those slushies,
Gaspar said gently. He seemed to understand. Billy smiled. He took the kindness as it was intended.
Yeah, the cream of high society. That is, when they're not threatening to shoot me through the head if I don't open the safe. Let me ask you a favor, Gaspar said. I'd like a little sanctuary, if you think it's all right. Just a little rest. I could lie down on the sofa for a bit. Would that be all right? You trust me to stay here while you're gone, young fella?
Billy hesitated only a moment. The very old man seemed okay, not a crazy, and certainly not a thief. And what was there to steal? Some tea that wasn't even Earl Grey?
Sure, that'll be okay, but I won't be coming back till 2 a.m., so just close the door behind you when you go. It'll lock automatically.
They shook hands. Billy shrugged into his still wet trench coat, and he went to the door. He paused to look back at Gaspar sitting in the lengthening shadows as evening came on.
It was nice getting to know you, Gaspar. You can make that a mutual pleasure, Billy. You're a nice young fella.
And Billy went to work, alone, as always. When he came home at 2, prepared to open a can of Hormel chili, he found the table set for dinner with the scent of an elegant beef stew enriching the apartment. There were new potatoes and stir-fried carrots and zucchini that had been lightly battered to delicate crispness, and cupcakes, white cake with chocolate frosting, from a bakery. And in that way, as gently as that, Gaspar insinuated himself into Billy Canetta's apartment and into his life. As they sat with tea and cupcakes, Billy said, "You don't have any place to go, do you?" The old man smiled and made one of those deprecating movements of the head. "Well, I'm not the sort of fellow who can bear to be homeless, but at the moment I'm what vaudevillians used to call at liberty." "Well, if you want to stay on a time, that would be okay," Billy said. "It's not very roomy here, but we seem to get on all right." "That's strongly kind of you, Billy. Yes, I'd like to be your roommate for a while. It won't be too long, though. My doctor tells me I'm not long for this world." He paused, looked into the teacup, and said softly, "I have to confess, I'm a little frightened to go. Having someone to talk to would be a great comfort." And Billy said, without preparation, "I was visiting the grave of a man who was in my rifle company in Vietnam. I go there sometimes." But there was such pain in his words that Gaspar did not press him for details. So the hours passed as they will, with or without permission. And when Gaspar asked Billy if they could watch the television to catch an early newscast, and Billy tuned in the old set just in time to pick up dire reports of another aborted disarmament talk, and Billy shook his head and observed that it wasn't only Gaspar who was frightened of something like death. Gaspar chuckled, patted Billy on the knee, and said with unassailable assurance, "Take my word for it, Billy, it isn't going to happen. No nuclear holocaust. Trust me when I tell you this, it'll never happen. Never, never, no, not ever, never." Billy smiled wanly. "And why not? What makes you so sure? You got some special inside information?" And Gaspar pulled out the magnificent timepiece, which Billy was seeing for the first time, and he said, "It's not going to happen because it's only 11 o'clock." Billy stared at the watch, which read 11 o'clock precisely. He consulted his wristwatch. "Well, I hate to tell you this, but your watch has stopped. It's almost 5:30. Gaspar smiled his own certain smile. "No, it's 11. And they made up the sofa for the very old man, who placed his pocket change and his fountain pen and the sumptuous turnip watch on the now silent television set, and they went to sleep. One day, Billy went off while Gaspar was washing the lunch dishes, and when he came back, he had a large paper bag from Toys R Us. Gaspar came out of the kitchenette, rubbing a plate with a souvenir dish towel from Niagara Falls, New York. He stared at Billy and the bag. "What's in the bag?" Billy inclined his head and indicated the very old man should join him in the middle of the room. Then he sat down cross-legged on the floor and dumped the contents of the bag. Gaspar stared with startlement and sat down beside him. So for 2 hours they played with tiny cars that turned into robots when the sections were unfolded. Gaspar was excellent at figuring out all the permutations of the Transformers, Starriers, and Gobots. He played well. And then they went for a walk. "I'll treat you to a matinee," Gaspar said, "but no films with Karen Black, Sandy Dennis, or Meryl Streep. They're always crying. Their noses are always red. I can't stand that." They started to cross the avenue. Stopped at the light was this year's Cadillac broom, vanity license plates, 10 coats of acrylic lacquer and 2 coats of clear, with a little retarder in the final color coat for a slow dry, of a magenta hue so rich that it approximated the shade of light shining through a decanter filled with Chateau Lafite Rothschild 1945. The man driving the Cadillac had no neck. His head sat thumped down hard on the shoulders. He stared straight ahead, took one last deep pull on the cigar, and threw it out the window. The still-smoking butt landed directly in front of Gaspar as he passed the car. The old man stopped, stared down at this coprolitic metaphor, and then stared at the driver. The eyes behind the wheel, the eyes of a macaque, did not waver from the stoplight's red circle. Just outside the window, someone was looking in, but the eyes of the rhesus were on the red circle. A line of cars stopped behind the broom. Gaspar continued to stare at the man in the Cadillac for a moment, and then, with creaking difficulty, he bent and picked up the smoldering butt of stogie. The old man walked the 2 steps to the car, as Billy watched in confusion, thrust his face forward till it was mere inches from the driver's profile, and said, with extreme sweetness, "I think you dropped this in our living room."
and as the glazed simian eyes turned to stare directly into the pedestrian's face, nearly nose to nose, Gaspar casually flipped the butt with its red glowing tip into the back seat of the Cadillac, where it began to burn a hole in the fine Corinthian leather. Three things happened simultaneously. The driver let out a howl, tried to see the butt in his rearview mirror, could not get the angle, tried to look over his shoulder into the back seat, but without a neck, could not perform that feat of agility, put the car into neutral, opened his door, and stormed into the street trying to grab Gaspar.
You fucking bastard, what do you think you're doing to my car, you asshole bastard? I'll kill you.
Billy's hair stood on end as he saw what Gaspar was doing. He rushed back the short distance in the crosswalk to grab the old man. Gaspar would not be dragged away, stood smiling with unconcealed pleasure at the mad bull rampage and screaming of the hysterical driver. Billy yanked as hard as he could, and Gaspar began to move away around the front of the Cadillac toward the far curb, still grinning with octogenaric charm. The light changed. These three things happened in the space of 5 seconds, abetted by the impatient honking of the cars behind the broom, as the light turned green. Screaming, dragging, honking, as the driver found he could not do three things at once. He could not go after Gaspar while the traffic was clanging at him, could not let go of the car door to crawl into the back seat, from which now came the stench of charring leather that could not be rectified by an inexpensive Tijuana tuck and roll, could not save his back seat, and at the same time stave off the hostility of a dozen drivers cursing and honking. He trembled there, torn three ways, doing nothing. Billy dragged Gaspar out of the crosswalk, out of the street, onto the curb, up the side street, into the alley, through a backyard, to the next street from the avenue. Puffing with exertion, Billy stopped at last 5 houses up the street. Gaspar was still grinning, chuckling softly with unconcealed pleasure at his puckish ways. Billy turned on him with wild gesticulations and babble. You're nuts!
How about that? The old man said, giving Billy an affectionate poke in the bicep.
Nuts! Loony! That guy would have torn off your head! What the hell's wrong with you, old man? Are you out of your boots?
I'm not crazy. I'm responsible.
Responsible? Responsible, for Christ's sakes! For what? For all the butts every yacht throws into the street?
The old man nodded. For butts and trash and pollution and toxic waste dumping in the dead of night. For bushes and cactus and the baobab tree. For pippin apples and even lima beans, which I despise. You mean, you show me someone who'll eat lima beans without being a gunpoint, I'll show you a pervert.
Billy was screaming, what the hell are you talking about?
I'm also responsible for dogs and cats and guppies and cockroaches and the President of the United States and Jonas Salk and your mother and the entire chorus line at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. Also their choreographer.
Who do you think you are, God?
Don't be sacrilegious. I'm too old to wash your mouth out with laundry soap. Of course I'm not God. I'm just an old man. But I'm responsible.
Gaspar started to walk away toward the corner and the avenue and a resumption of their route. Billy stood where the old man's words had pinned him.
Come on, young fella, Gaspar said, walking backward to speak to him. We'll miss the beginning of the movie. I hate that. I'll make an exception in the case of Meryl Streep, but you buy the popcorn.
Billy had finished eating, and they were sitting in the dimness of the apartment, only the lamp in the corner lit. The old man had gone to the County Art Museum and had bought inexpensive prints, Max Ernst, Jerome, Richard Dadd, a subtle Feininger, which he had mounted in Instaframes. They sat in silence for a time, relaxing, and then murmuring trivialities in a pleasant undertone. Finally, Gaspar said,
I've been thinking a lot about my dying. I like what Woody Allen said.
Billy slid to a more comfortable position in the lounger. Yeah, what was that?
He said, I don't mind dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Billy snickered.
I feel something like that, Billy. I'm not afraid to go. But I don't want to leave Minna entirely. The times I spend with her, talking to her, well, it gives me a feeling that we're still in touch. When I go, that's the end of Minna. She'll be well and truly dead. We never had any children. Almost everyone who knew us is gone. No relatives. And we never did anything important that anyone would put in a record book. So that's the end of us. For me, I don't mind. But I wish there was someone who knew about Minna. Ah, she was a remarkable person. So Billy said, tell me, Dad. I'll remember for you. Memories in no particular order, some as strong as ropes that could pull the ocean ashore, some that shimmered and swayed in the faintest breeze like spider webs. The entire person, all the little movements, that dimple that appeared when she was amused at something foolish he had said, their youth together, their love, the procession of their days toward middle age, the small cheers and the pain of dreams never realized, so much about him as he spoke of her. His voice soft and warm, and filled with a longing so deep and true that he had to stop frequently because the words broke and would not come out till he had thought away some of the passion. He thought of her and was glad. He had gathered her together, all her dowry of love and taking care of him, her clothes and the way she wore them, her favorite knick-knacks, a few clever remarks, and he packed it all up and delivered it to a new repository. The very old man gave Minna to Billy Canetta for safekeeping. Dawn had come. The light filtering in through the blinds was saffron. "Thank you, Dad," Billy said. He could not name the feeling that had taken him hours earlier, but he said this: "I've never had to be responsible for anything or anyone in my whole life. I never belonged to anybody. I don't know why. It didn't bother me because I didn't know any other way to be." Then his position changed there in the lounger. He sat up in a way that Gaspar thought was important, as if Billy were about to open the secret box buried at his center. And Billy spoke so softly the old man had to strain to hear him at first. I didn't even know him. We were defending the airfield at Da Nang. Did I tell you we were 1st Battalion, 9th Marines? Charlie was massing for a big push out of Quang Nai Province south of us. It looked as if they were going to try to take the provincial capital. See, my rifle company was assigned to protect the perimeter, and they kept sending in patrols to bite us. Every day we'd lose some poor bastard who scratched his head when he shouldn't have. It was June, late in June, cold and a lot of rain. The foxholes were hip deep in water. Flares first. Our howitzers started firing, and then the sky was full of tracers, and I started to turn toward the bushes when I heard something coming, and these two main force regulars in dark blue uniforms came toward me. I could see them so clearly. Long black hair, all crouched over, and they started firing, and a goddamn carbine seized up, wouldn't fire, and I pulled out the banana clip, tried to slap in another, but they saw me, and they just turned a couple of AK-47s on me, and God, I remember everything slowed down. I looked at those things, 7.62mm assault rifles they were. I got crazy for a second. I tried to figure out in my own mind if they were Russian-made, or they were Chinese-made, or Czech, or North Korean, and it was so bright from the flares, I could see them starting to squeeze off the rounds, and then from out of nowhere, this Lance Corporal jumped out at them, and he yelled some damn thing like, "Hey, you VC fucks, look at here!" Except it wasn't that. I never could recall what he said, actually, and they turned to brace him, and they opened him up like a baggie full of blood, and he was all over me, and the bushes, and oh God, there was pieces of him floating on the water I was standing in. Billy was heaving breath with impossible weight. His hands moved in the air before his face without pattern or goal. He kept looking into far corners of the dawn-lit room as if special facts might present themselves to fill out the reasons behind what he was saying. Oh, Jesus, he was floating on the water. Oh, Christ, he got in my boots. And a wail of pain, so loud it blotted out the sound of traffic beyond the apartment. And he began to moan, but not cry. And the moaning kept on. And Gaspar came from the sofa and held him and said such words as, "It's all right." But they might not have been those words, or any words. And pressed against the old man's shoulder, Billy Canetta ran on, only half sane. "He wasn't my friend. I never knew him. I'd never talked to him. I'd seen him, but he was just this guy, and there wasn't any reason to do that. I mean, he didn't know whether I was a good guy or a shit or anything, so why did he do that? I mean, he didn't need to do that. They wouldn't have seen him. He was dead before I killed them. He was gone already, and I never got to say thank you, or thank you, or..."
anything. And now he's in that grave, see? So I came here to live so I can go there, but I try and try to say thank you, and he's dead, and he can't hear me, he can't hear anything. He's just down there, down in the ground, and I can't say thank you. Oh, Jesus, Jesus, why don't he hear me? I just want to say thanks.
Billy Canetta wanted to assume the responsibility for saying thanks, but that was possible only on a night that would never come again. And this was the day. Gaspar took him to the bedroom and put him down to sleep in exactly the same way one would soothe an old, sick dog. Then he went to his sofa, and because it was the only thing he could imagine saying, he murmured, "He'll be all right, Minna. Really, he will." When Billy left for the 7-Eleven the next evening, Gaspar was gone. It was an alternate day, and that meant he was out at the cemetery. Billy fretted that he shouldn't be there alone, but the old man had a way of taking care of himself. Billy was not smiling as he thought of his friend, and the word friend echoed as he realized that, yes, this was his friend, truly and really his friend. He wondered how old Gaspar was and how soon Billy Canetta would be once again what he had always been, alone. When he returned to the apartment at 2:30, Gaspar was asleep, cocooned in his blanket on the sofa. Billy went in and tried to sleep, but hours later, when sleep would not come, when thoughts of murky water and calcium nightlight on dark foliage kept him staring at the bedroom ceiling, he came out of the room for a drink of water. He wandered around the living room, not wanting to be by himself, even if the only companionship in this sleepless night was breathing heavily, himself in sleep. He stared out the window. Clouds lay in chiffon strips across the sky, the squealing of tires from the street. Sighing, idle in his movement around the room, he saw the old man's pocket watch lying on the coffee table beside the sofa. He walked to the table. If the watch was still stopped at 11 o'clock, perhaps he would borrow it and have it repaired. It would be a nice thing to do for Gaspar. He loved that beautiful timepiece. Billy bent to pick it up. The watch, stopped at the V of 11 precisely, levitated at an angle, floating away from him. Billy Canetta felt a shiver travel down his back to burrow in at the base of his spine. He reached for the watch hanging in air before him. It floated away just enough that his fingers massaged empty space. He tried to catch it. The watch eluded him, lazily turning away like an opponent who knows he is in no danger of being struck from behind. Then Billy realized Gaspar was awake. Turned away from the sofa, nonetheless, he knew the old man was observing him and the blissful floating watch. He looked at Gaspar. They did not speak for a long time. Then,
"I'm going back to sleep," Billy said quietly.
"I think you have some questions," Gaspar replied.
"Questions? No, no, of course not, Dad. Why in the world would I have questions? I'm still asleep."
But that was not the truth, because he had not been asleep that night.
"Do you know what Gaspar means? Do you remember the three wise men of the Bible, the Magi?"
I don't want any frankincense and myrrh. I'm going back to bed. See, I'm going now. You see, this is me going right now.
"Gaspar means master of the treasure, keeper of the secrets, paladin of the palace."
Billy was staring at him, not walking into the bedroom, just staring at him. As the elegant timepiece floated to the old man, who extended his hand palm up to receive it, the watch nestled in his hand unmoving, and it made no sound. No sound at all.
"You go back to bed, but will you go out to the cemetery with me tomorrow? It's important."
"Why?"
"Because I believe I'll be dying tomorrow."
It was a nice day, cool and clear. Not at all a day for dying, but neither had been many such days in Southeast Asia, and death had not been deterred. They stood at Minna's gravesite, and Gaspar opened his shooting stick to form a seat, and he thrust the spike into the ground, and he settled onto it and sighed. and said to Billy Canetta, "I'm growing cold as that stone. You want my jacket?" "No, I'm cold inside." He looked around at the sky, at the grass, at the rows of markers. "I've been responsible for all of this and more." "You've said that before. Young fella, are you by any chance familiar in your reading with an old novel by James Hilton called Lost Horizon? Perhaps you saw the movie." "Ah, it was a wonderful movie, actually much better than the book. Mr. Capra's greatest achievement, A Human Testament. Ronald Coleman was superb. Do you know the story?" "Yes." "Do you remember the High Lama played by Sam Jaffe? His name was Father Perot?" "Yes." "Do you remember how he passed on the caretakership of that magical hidden world, Shangri-La, to Ronald Coleman?" "Yes, I remember that." Billy paused. "Then he died. He was very old, and he died." Gaspar smiled up at Billy. "Very good, Billy. I knew you were a good boy. So now, if you remember all that, may I tell you a story? It's not a very long story." Billy nodded, smiling at his friend. "In 1582, Pope Gregory XIII decreed that the civilized world would no longer observe the Julian calendar. October 4th, 1582, was followed the next day by October 15th. 11 days vanished from the world. 170 years later, the British Parliament followed suit, and September 2nd, 1752, was followed the next day by September 14th. Now, why did he do that, the Pope?" Billy was bewildered by the conversation. Because he was bringing it into sync with the real world, the solstices and equinoxes, when to plant, when to harvest." Gaspar waggled a finger at him with pleasure. "Excellent, young fella. And you're correct when you say Gregory abolished the Julian calendar because its error of one day in every 128 years had moved the vernal equinox to March 11th. That's what the history books say. It's what every history book says. But what if?" "What if what? I don't know what you're talking about." "What if Pope Gregory had the knowledge revealed to him that he must readjust time in the minds of men? What if the excess time in 1582 wasn't just 11 days, but 11 days in 1 hour? What if he accounted for those 11 days, vanished those 11 days, but that 1 hour slipped free, was left loose to bounce through eternity? A very special hour, an hour that must never be used, an hour that must never toll. What if?" Billy spread his hands. "What if, what if, what if? It's all just philosophy. It doesn't mean anything. Hours aren't real. Time isn't something that you can bottle up. So what if there is an hour out there somewhere that..." And he stopped. He grew tense and leaned down to the old man. "The watch. Your watch. It doesn't work. It stopped." Gaspar nodded. "At 11 o'clock. My watch works, Billy. It keeps very special time for one very special hour." Billy touched Gaspar's shoulder. Carefully, he asked, "Who are you, Dad?" The old man did not smile as he said, "Gaspar, keeper, guardian, paladin." Father Perot was hundreds of years old. Gaspar shook his head with a wistful expression on his old face. "I'm 86 years old, Billy. You asked me if I thought I was God. Not God, not Father Perot, not an immortal, just an old man who will die too soon. Are you Ronald Coleman?" Billy nervously touched his lower lip with a finger. He looked at Gaspar as long as he could, then turned away. He walked off a few paces, stared at the barren trees. It seemed suddenly much chillier here in this place of entombed remembrances. From a distance, he said, "But it's only, what? It's a chronological convenience, like daylight saving time. Spring forward, fall back. We don't actually lose an hour. We get it back." Gaspar stared at Minna's grave. "At the end of April, I lost an hour. If I die now, I'll die an hour short in my life. I won't get it back. I'll have been cheated out of 1 hour I want, Billy." He swayed toward all he had left of Minna.
one last hour I could have with my old girl. That's what I'm afraid of, Billy. I have that hour in my possession. I'm afraid I'll use it. God help me. I want so much to use it.
Billy came to him.
Tense and chilled, he said, Why must that hour never toll? Gaspar drew a deep breath and tore his eyes away from the grave, his gaze locked with Billy's, and he told him. The years, all the days and hours, exist. As solid and as real as mountains and oceans and men and women and the baobab tree. Look, he said, at the lines in my face and deny that time is real. Consider these dead weeds that were once alive and try to believe it's all just vapor or the mutual agreement of popes and Caesars and young men like you. The lost hour must never come, Billy, for in that hour it all ends. The light, the wind, the stars, this magnificent open place we call the universe, it all ends. And in its place, waiting, always waiting, is eternal darkness. No new beginnings, no world without end, just the infinite emptiness. And he opened his hand, which had been lying in his lap, and there in his palm rested the watch, making no sound at all, and stopped dead at 11 o'clock. Should it strike 12, Billy, eternal night falls, from which there is no recall. There he sat, this very old man, just a perfectly normal old man, the most recent in the endless chain of keepers of the lost hour, descended in possession from Caesar and Pope Gregory XIII, down through the centuries of men and women who had served as caretakers of the excellent timepiece, and now he was dying, and now he wanted to cling to life as every man and woman clings to life, no matter how awful or painful or empty, even if it is for one more hour. The suicide falling from the bridge at the final instant tries to fly, tries to climb back up the sky. This weary old man who only wanted to stay one brief hour more with Minna, who was afraid that his love would cost the universe. He looked at Billy, and he extended his hand with the watch waiting for its next paladin. So softly Billy could barely hear him, knowing that he was denying himself what he most wanted at this last place in his life, he whispered, "If I die without passing it on, it will begin to tick." "We're not me," Billy said. "Why did you pick me? I'm no one special. I'm not someone like you. I run an all-night service, Mark. There's nothing special about me the way there is about you. I'm not Ronald Coleman. I don't want to be responsible. I've never been responsible." Gaspar smiled gently. "You've been responsible for me?" Billy's rage vanished. He looked wounded. "Look at us, Billy. Look at what color you are, and look at what color I am. You took me in as a friend. I think of you as worthy, Billy. Worthy." They remained there that way in silence as the wind rose. And finally, in a timeless time, Billy nodded. Then the young man said, "You won't be losing Minna, Dad. Now you'll go to the place where she's been waiting for you, just as she was when you first met her. There's a place where we find everything we've ever lost through the years."
"That's good, Billy, that you tell me that. I'd like to believe it, too, but you see, I'm a pragmatist. I believe what exists, like rain and Minna's grave right here, and the hours that pass that we can't see, but they are. I'm afraid, Billy. I'm afraid this will be the last time I can speak to her, so I ask a favor. Yes, payment, in return for my life spent protecting the watch. I ask for 1 minute of the hour, Billy. 1 minute to call her back so we can stand face to face and I can touch her and say goodbye. You'll be the new protector of this watch, Billy, so I ask you, please, just let me steal 1 minute.
Billy could not speak. The look on Gaspar's face was without horizon, empty as tundra, bottomless. The child left alone in darkness, the pain of eternal waiting. He knew he could never deny this old man, no matter what he asked. And in the silence, he heard a voice say,
"No!"
and it was his own. He had spoken without conscious volition, strong and determined, and without the slightest room for reversal. If a part of his heart had been swayed by compassion, that part had been instantly overridden. No. A final, unshakable no. For an instant, Gaspar looked crestfallen. His eyes clouded with tears, and Billy felt something twist and break within himself at the sight. He knew he had hurt the old man. Quickly, but softly, he said urgently, "You know that would be wrong, Dad. We mustn't..." Gaspar said nothing. Then he reached out with his free hand and took Billy's. It was an affectionate touch. "That was the last test, young fella. Oh, you know I've been testing you, don't you? This important item couldn't go to just anyone. And you passed the test, my friend. My last, best friend. When I said I could bring her back from where she's gone, here, in this place we've both come to so often, to talk to someone lost to us, I knew you would understand that anyone could be brought back in that stolen minute. I knew you wouldn't use it for yourself, no matter how much you wanted it. But I wasn't sure that, as much as you like me, it might not sway you. But you wouldn't even give it to me, Billy." He smiled up at him, his eyes now clear and steady. "I'm content, Billy. You needn't have worried. Minna and I don't need that minute. But if you're to carry on for me, I think you do need it. You're in pain, and that's no good for someone who carries this watch. You've got to heal, Billy. So I give you something you would never take for yourself. I give you a going-away present." And he started the watch, whose ticking was as loud and as clear as a baby's first sound, and the sweep second hand began to move away from 11 o'clock. And then the wind rose, and the sky seemed to cloud over, and it grew colder, with a remarkable silver-blue mist that rolled across the cemetery. And though he didn't see it emerge from that grave at a distance far to the right, Billy Canetta saw a shape move toward him. A soldier in the uniform of a day past, and his rank was Lance Corporal. He came toward Billy Canetta, and Billy went to meet him as Gaspar watched. They stood together, and Billy spoke to him. And the man whose name Billy had never known when he was alive answered. And then he faded as the seconds ticked away, faded, and was gone. And the silver-blue mist rolled through them and past them and was gone. And the soldier was gone. And Billy stood alone. And when he turned back to look across the grounds to his friend, he saw that Gaspar had fallen from the shooting stick. He lay on the ground. Billy rushed to him and fell to his knees and lifted him onto his lap. Gaspar was still.
"Oh, God! Dad, you should have heard what he said. Oh, geez, he let me go! He let me go so I didn't even have to say I was sorry! He told me he didn't even see me in that foxhole! He never knew he saved my life! I said, 'Thank you!' And he said, 'No, thank you, that he hadn't died for nothing! Oh, please, Dad, please don't be dead yet! I want to tell you!'"
And the old man, the very old man, as sometimes happens, opened his eyes. "May I remember you to my old girl, Billy?" And his eyes closed, and his caretakership was at an end as his hand opened, and the most excellent timepiece, now stopped again at 11:01, floated from his palm and waited till Billy Canetta extended his hand, and then it floated down and lay there silently. Safe, protected. There, in the place where all lost things returned, the young man sat on the cold ground, rocking the body of his friend, and he was in no hurry to leave. There was time.